Okay, so here we've got questions. So we've got here today, and question number one is, dear Ajahn, how do make peace, be kind, be gentle to discomfort? It seems easy to do for the rest, for sloth, restlessness, etc., as they eventually go away, but discomfort doesn't want to go away. Rather, I find it progressively gets worse, leading to pain. I've tried changing positions, but the discomfort pain just changes along with it and comes along anyway. Okay, now, with discomfort, sometimes you can change your posture and the discomfort goes away. So in meditation, if you've got a bad knee or a back, then adjust the posture. So it's okay to adjust the posture in the middle of the meditation. Sure enough, you disturb the progress if you move, but you disturb it a tiny bit. And then the discomfort goes away, and another minute or two you're back where you left off, and you can go much deeper. But if you try and endure the comfort, a lot of time it gets worse and worse and worse, and you don't get anywhere in your meditation. And that means that you're not following the middle way, you know, you're not just looking after your body, you're trying to control it. So a lot of time discomfort is the best thing to move, you know, mindfully and sort of slowly, so you don't disturb your progress in meditation too much. However, if it keeps coming back, have a look at your posture and get a couple of more cushions, get a stool or use a chair. Most of the time people get discomfort because they insist on sitting on the chair or sitting on the floor. And they might sit on the floor because sometimes they think they're tough guys, tough girls. They think only wusses, namby-pamby, cream puffs use chairs. And you're a real meditator, so you're not going to use a chair. And of course, that's where you get the pain from. Every time I've gone over to pilgrimage to India, in the big stupa at Nalanda, there is carving of the Buddha sitting on a chair. And I love telling people that, see, it's, you know, you think you're better than the Buddha sitting on the floor. Even the Buddha used a chair. So seeing that is encouraging people to be kind to their body. So sit on a chair. Do a walking meditation to get the body fit and healthy. But nevertheless, there will always be some discomfort. And that's just the nature of the body. So if there is discomfort, and it's not going to go away by moving, by walking or by anything, then what can you do with it? You've got no choice. Like it or lump it. And so if you lump it, it just gets worse, worse. You add the mental pain and suffering to the physical pain. So when you make peace, be kind, be gentle, you find at the very least the pain gets less, the discomfort gets less. Because you're removing the mental part. And of course you all know that there'll be sometimes in your life you have aches and pains, physical discomforts, which you can do nothing about except make peace with it. And once you do that, you just go into it, you make peace with it, you're kind to it. Just like that simile of the demon in the emperor's palace. You know, a lot of pains are anger-eating demons. Get out of here, I want to meditate, I don't want to have this ache, I don't want to have this pain, I don't want to have this sickness. And it gets worse. So you have the pain, welcome sickness, thank you for coming to visit me. And then you find the sickness gets much less. Even, we just finished our 3 months range retreat, the Wasis and the Pansar. I'd still have to work hard teaching the monks and doing all these bits and pieces, but every year I do my 15 days in my cave. And this time, I think 4 or 5 days into it, I got this very, very sore back just under my shoulder blades. And of course, what do? You try and move it this way, move it that way, trying to sort of get rid of it. And it's getting so bad, I thought I'd call one of the monks in to give me a massage. But before I did that, I think, oh, come on, just why don't you practice your own teachings? So I just made peace with it. Went right into it, made peace, was kind with it and gentle. And it went totally away and didn't come back for the ever. So it's amazing just how you can get a pain like that, which is driving you crazy, and we know how to make peace with it, really make peace with it, and be kind to it, be gentle with it, it vanishes. It's amazing to watch. So that was just a few weeks ago. But if you do that, and you try and make peace with it, but it doesn't go away. And you complain, Ajahn Brahm, I did that, but it didn't go away. They say you weren't making peace with it. You were doing a deal with it. You're saying, I'll make peace as long as you go away. That's not making peace. That's just a different way of controlling. So making peace means just letting it be. Saying to that pain, you can be here for the rest of my life. Get worse if you want. That's how much I love you and care for you. Unconditional mindfulness to the discomfort. Now, there are some discomforts in life, that's all you can do. Try it, it's very effective. So, again, if there's something you can do, change the posture, scratch or something, sit on a chair, do it. If there's nothing you can do, then you go back to make peace, be kind, be gentle. And you find that it's easy to endure then. Okay, next question. Okay, this one. Dear Ajahn Brahm, form is not separate from emptiness. Emptiness is not separate from form. Form is emptiness, emptiness is form. That's Heart Sutra. How does one arrive to such an equation? Oh, by thinking too much. You know that story. It's one of the great stories from in Zen Buddhism. There was this wandering monk, and he was wandering from place to place, you know, sleeping out and just begging his food. And he hadn't done very well for many days, so he was very hungry. And as he was wandering into this, good town, you know, he asked, are there any Buddhists in here? And he said, well, actually, one of the most devout and sincere Buddhists is this lady who owns the best restaurant in town. And he thought, wow, I'm going to get a good meal today. So he went into the restaurant with his begging bowl. And of course the owner came out to greet him. Welcome, monk. And he said, anything I can do for you? And he said, well, you know, it'd be nice to have something to eat. And he said, oh, but you have to teach me Dhamma first. Teach me some Dhamma. And so the monk decided to really give us some deep Dhamma. Said, form is not separate from emptiness. Emptiness is not separate from form. And the owner of the restaurant said, sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Said, sit down, monk. I'm going to get you something special to eat. And the monk thought, at last, today I'm going to get a really good meal. I've inspired this woman. She actually understands the depth of this teaching. So he sat down. He was already salivating when the owner herself came with this huge platter of food. That's what he thought it was, because it was covered with the cover to keep it hot. And she presented it to him. Here you are, monk. And when she took off the cover, there was nothing there. Form is emptiness. Emptiness is form. Eat emptiness, monk. So it's not actually quite the same, is it? Form and emptiness. You know, if you ate emptiness tomorrow, you'd be very hungry. You find it's actually not the same as form. So that sometimes, you know, these aren't universal truths. They're just pointing to something. What he was saying, emptiness of what? And so emptiness is not an absolute. It's relative to what it's empty of. And that's actually how the Buddha taught emptiness. This retreat is empty of your husband. Oh, what bliss. This retreat is empty of having to go to work. Oh, what bliss. So remember what this retreat is empty of. It's not empty of everything. You know, you have your huts. You know, you have your beds. The rooms aren't empty. You've got a toilet to sit on. But, yes, it's empty of many things. So what is empty of? That's what we recognize. But it's not empty of everything. It's empty of a self, empty of enduring reality. But not empty of everything. Otherwise you'll go hungry. So how does one arrive, by what form, and what point, to what level of understanding can this infusion be realized? Help, this is bewilderment from the Heart Sutra, yes. And again, I think I mentioned to you here that where that actually comes from, that actually comes from just, you know, straight down the line Buddhism. Remember, the Heart Sutra was after the time of the Buddha, and it was just trying to adapt and explain and put it in like one monk's own words. And what it's actually saying is, you know, the five khandhas, the five skandhas, you know, your body, your feelings, your perceptions, your will, that's the most important of the sankharas, and your consciousness is empty of a self. Empty of an abiding entity. That's what it's calling emptiness. And so, you know, people say that. And Charles said, Wang, there's nothing there. It's just empty. So this is just the teaching that, you know, your body, there's nobody in there. And if you're looking for inside, you know, where is this thing which is in charge? Try in charge of me. And is there somebody at the controls? Just like at a car, you've got a driver at the wheel. Is there somewhere in my brain? If I open up my brain, is there a guy at sort of at the wheel or someone with a little mouse telling you what to do? Is that your being? There's nobody in here. So it's empty of an abiding entity, which is easy to know that because you've seen people die. So you know that's not you. There's not an eternal being in there. But then your feelings, is that you? It can't be you. Sometimes you're happy, sometimes you're sad, sometimes having a good time, sometimes having a bad time. Which is the right you? None of them are. But then you go to your perception. Yeah, it's pretty easy to see your perception, the way you look at things. You know, you can't rely upon perceptions. Ask any psychologist, they have these amazing tricks, you know, to try and trick your perceptions. So what you think is there, is not there. And perception especially is just so, you might call it lazy. It only sees what it has to see. You know, I know that great experiment which they did, where they got this guy to go up to somebody at the university and just ask him a question. Where is the chemistry lab? And before the person could answer, these two workmen came between the two of them with a door. It was very rude. But no, they soon passed by. So the person could ask the question again, where's the chemistry lab? But what happened? The first person who asked the question went along with the door. And was replaced by a second person who was actually behind the door. So the first person who asked the question, where is the chemistry lab, was not the second person who asked the question, where is the chemistry lab, and they changed them all around. You know, they had like a Caucasian guy and then a black, you know, woman afterwards. And the person who was asked the question didn't realize that the questioner had changed. Why? Because all the perception really noticed, it was so lazy. The only important thing was what the question was. The person asking the question just was not recognized, it wasn't perceived. I think you've seen that before. There's lots and lots of great, fun ways of showing just how when you perceive something, you only perceive just a fraction of what's really there, only the important stuff. Everything else, you just don't see. And you've got the next two, obviously the big ones, the will, to see that's empty of a self. It's not coming from you. Empty. Nothing there. And your consciousness, the one listening to me now, you go right inside and it's like a bubble. That's what the Buddha called it. He called it like a magician's trick. Nothing there. That's what it's like. Your consciousness. Just a trick. This is what you call like the emptiness. And because of that, you know, you realize what the Buddha was saying. And the Heart Sutra was just saying the same thing. It's empty of a self. So, no, it's just body, that's all. It's just feelings, it's just perceptions, it's just will. Your will comes, your will goes, but it's not my business. Consciousness comes, consciousness goes, but nothing to do with me. So it's empty of me, mine, and the self. So that's what the emptiness really means. And when actually you go back to the Buddha's teachings, you can just say, you know, just... monk, teach me Dhamma. Yeah, the body is empty of itself, but it's also empty of food, and so please feed me. So it's much more practical, so you always get fed if you're a Theravada monk. Could you kindly explain how one could use the 4 Iddhipadas skillfully to one's meditation without striving too much to get anywhere? The Iddhipadas are, so it's the road to success, which is Chanda, Virya, what's the next one? Citta and Vimaksa. So what it means, the Chanda is actually like, it's interesting, it's not so much will, sometimes it's called will, but we use that word in the constitution of the Sangha. If the community is making a decision and I'm busy, I can give my consent to proceed in my absence. That's called Chanda. So it's like an approval. So in this particular case, the Itipadas, it's not will, it's like an approval for you to let go. It is the goal of stopping, the goal of renunciation, the goal of peace. So when we have the Itipadas, and that's the basic, the chanda is approving of the what you're supposed to be doing, and energy which comes from that, the chitta, the application of the mind onto that goal, and obviously we're monks, so is just investigating in case there's any obstacles to that, you know, getting that goal. So it's all right to set yourself a goal in this retreat, but not jhanas, not nimittas. Have the goal of peace, contentment, stillness. Make that your goal. So if you make your wrong goal, you really get stuffed up. If you want to get nimittas, if that's your goal, you're going to really sort of have a hard time. You're going to get disappointed. But if you set your goal as peace, today I'm just going to be peaceful. I'm going to relax. I'm going to be still. I'm going to be kind. Make that your goal. Because those are the primary goals which you achieve those through things like letting go. And when you reach those primary goals, the secondary goals of nimittas, jhanas, enlightenment, they come as natural consequence. So peace is the most important thing. So when you're meditating, what's the point of meditating? To make peace, to generate peace. Not to generate enlightenment, but to generate the cause of enlightenment, peace. To go against craving, not to make more craving. So set the goal right. I'm here to make peace. I'm here to have pity, to have joy. I'm here to be content. So make that your goal. And then the Itipadas work with those goals and you get incredibly peaceful. And of course from that peace, that's where you get all the rasmatas, nimittas and jhanas and everything. You stated that one should not strive strenuously after any attainment. However, the Bodhisattva did strive very hard over many births to perfect the 10 paramis. Is there not a contradiction here? He did strive in his last life, and he got nowhere. That's why he sort of said, don't do that. His first teaching after he became enlightened, he said, don't do what I did. Do the middle path. And as for over many births to perfect the 10 paramis perfections, I don't agree with that at all. That's after the time of the Buddha. If any of you really are interested, then have a look at the Gatikara Sutta in the Majjhima Nikaya. This is in the Agamas, the Chinese version. This is a Dinki Dai authentic sutra of the Buddha. And there, this Gatikara was a potter in the time of Kassapa the Buddha. This is a previous Buddha, which is not that long ago. It's supposed to be in this world cycle. So you know, how long have human beings been around? You know, I don't know, but I certainly do know that in India there was these great civilizations in Harappa and Mohenjo-daro, which were contemporary, actually before the Babylonian civilization. I know that people in the West are just so Eurocentric. They think that civilization started in the Middle East, certainly in Babylon. But in India, in the Indus River, Harappa Mohenjo-daro was pre-Babylon. And it was a huge civilization and very organized. And if there was a Kassapa the Buddha, that's probably where he was. And anyway, so if in this particular sutta, Gatikara was a Brahmin, and his best friend was called Jyotipala. So Jyotipala was a Brahmin, Gatikara was a pork potter, but they're best of friends. And Gatikara was a disciple of the Buddha Kassapa, previous Buddha. And he was actually an anagami, a non-returner. The only reason he didn't become a monk was because he had 2 blind parents and he had to look after those blind parents. But he always wanted his best friend Jyotipala to go and see the Buddha Kassapa. But Jyotipala would always, you know, criticize Kassapa the Buddha. Who was to go and see just a bald-head, no-good, lazy, slob-like, you know, Kassapa? You know, what's the point? He called him like a shaven-headed sort of no-good. And it took, the whole sutta was talking about how Gatikara was trying to get Jyotipala to see the Buddha. And eventually he dragged him by the hair. Now in Asian culture, you don't touch people on the head. and to drag someone by the hair, I mean, that was just going too far. But instead of getting upset and angry, Jodhipada says, "You go that far to get me to see this monk of yours? He must be something special. I'll go." So Jodhipada went to see the Buddha Kassapa. And of course, as soon as he saw the Buddha Kassapa, he was totally converted, so much so that he became a monk. And then the story continues on, but that's the important part of the story so far, because at the end of the sutta, the Buddha was teaching the sutta, he said, "I was Jodhipada, that was me in a previous life." Now that is our Buddha in a previous life, born as a Brahmin, who would even not even recognize the previous Buddha, and would actually speak badly of him. So much for the paramitas. In a very, very recent life of Buddha Gautama, he would actually use wrong speech to a Buddha, the previous Buddha Kassapa. And if you're in the Devata Sanyutta, which is Sanyutta Nikaya, this is authentic teachings of the Buddha, there we have, just after the Buddha's enlightenment, our Buddha Gautama, just under the Bodhi tree at Bodh Gaya, one of the people who came to congratulate him was Gatikara. And there's a little poem in there. And Gatikara says, "In our previous life, we lived in the same village. You were Jodhipala, I was Gatikara. Now I was an Anagami, so I'm now up in the Sudawasa, and now I've come to congratulate you. You've gone one better. You're our Buddha. Well done." And that's actually in our suttas. So that's actually a story of the previous Buddha. When we have the 10 paramitas, it's interesting. It was the Mahayana started that with 6 paramitas, with the Bodhisattva path. But Theravada, you know what it's like, doing one better than your opponents. So 6 paramitas in Mahayana, so Theravada had to have 10 paramitas. You know, to show their superior. It's crazy stuff. But because the Theravada decided to have 10 paramitas, then they had the 10 previous lives of the Buddha, which is called the 10 Jatakas, the last of which was Vaisantara Jataka, you know, in Thai, called Vaisandorn. Now that is totally after the time of the Buddha, and that doesn't make any sense whatsoever. So it's this stuff which was written way after the time of the Buddha. Because the previous life of the Buddha was almost certainly as Jodhipala in the time of Kassapa. So very recently, the Buddha was a monk, a bhikkhu under a Buddha. He obviously had something. What do you think he attained under Kassapa the Buddha? You'd think at least he was a soul one. The Sotapanna, you know, actually studying under a Buddha. Maybe he was even more than that. Maybe a once returner. He couldn't have been an Anagami, otherwise he couldn't get reborn again. And they say that people who are once-returners, Sakadagamis, for the most part, get reborn in the Tusita realm. Gautama, where did he come down to earth from? The Tusita realm. And according to the legend, one of the first things he said, "This is my last life." How could he have known that? Unless he was a once-returner. There's strong circumstantial evidence. And our Buddha, Gautama, was a once-returner and finished his job under the Bodhi tree and became the Buddha. Changes all this paramita business. But again, evidence is there. Another sacred cow bites the dust. "Thank you for tirelessly teaching us from all angles. It's slowly sinking in. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu." That's always like praise, and thank you very much, I deserve that. I've taught that before. Why is it when somebody praises you, say, "Oh, it's nothing, nothing, just do my job." "No, I really work hard, so I deserve your praise. I really don't understand the concept that if you forgive yourself, then you won't go to hell. Your talk on Saturday. What about two people who do dreadful things and feel no remorse or guilt? that idea of remorse and guilt is a very Christian thing. And it's actually, when I was teaching in the law school in my local university, UWA, because, you know, giving lectures for a long time on, you know, law and religion, I said, this is one of the things that the legal system should actually understand. That if you're really a strong Buddhist, you won't feel remorse. And if you don't feel remorse at the trial, you are given an extra few years on your sentence. It's really unfair. It's all about this guilt thing. You were taught when you were with your parents, you know, if you felt sad and remorse, you didn't get punished so much. But if you're a Buddhist, you let it go. It's what you're supposed to do. It doesn't mean you're mean and evil when you let things go. Yeah, I did a bad thing. I've learned from it. Now I'm moving on. You callous person. Extra 5 years in jail for you. But if you do dreadful things, no remorse or guilt, the remorse, the guilt which you feel when you've done something wrong, that does not help you at all. That usually makes you actually repeat the bad thing again, because you feel you're not worth anything. You're a bad person. And when you sort of identify with being a bad person, you go on, associate with other bad person, that's bad people, that's where you think you belong, and just become a bad person again. Every time I've been to jails, I've never seen a criminal in the jails. Every time I've been into prisons, I've never seen a murderer, a thief, a rapist. I've never seen any of those. I've only seen a person who's murdered, a person who's raped, a person who's stolen, but I've never seen a thief. It's obvious. They're not a thief. It's much more than that. You know, they don't thieve every second of their life. They're not a murderer, you know, every day, every hour. They do many other things. So why is it when they do one or two really awful things, that's what you become? You're the murderer. I've only murdered once. I did many other good things in my life. No, you're a murderer. So when you say they're a person who's murdered rather than a murderer, it changes the whole ball game. And from that you can get forgiveness. You don't need that guilt, because the guilt does not help. It just makes you, again, you feel depressed, angry at yourself. You deny yourself happiness. And I've already mentioned that to one person on the interviews. Each one of you on this retreat, you deserve to be enlightened. You deserve to be happy. I give you permission to be happy. It doesn't matter what terrible things you've done in your life. You can still be happy. So you don't need to feel remorse and guilt, because remorse and guilt is what stops you getting nimittas, getting peaceful, because I don't deserve it. Now why should I get enlightened and sort of things which I've done in my life? Angulimala, the serial killer, he became enlightened, he could let go. So this forgiveness thing is something which is very important for people who are Westerners or people who have been brought up in a Western world, where you've been trained at schools, you know, by the nuns who taught you at school, or the people who were trained by Christians in their school. You're evil, you're bad, especially if you're a woman. You tempted Adam. It's all your fault. That's crazy, isn't it? That is evil, to make people feel guilty. So you aren't guilty. You are totally free to be happy. So you don't need to feel remorse or guilt. For instance, suicide bombers who killed a tube full of people. They're not suicide bombers. They're people who blew themselves up. They're people. They're much more than that. They believed in what they did. Felt no good and believed they were martyrs and died for God. Yeah, I know. But once they get reborn, they realize they made a big mistake. So they made a mistake. So they think, oh gee, I shouldn't have done that. So they can try again and do better next life. A really good person who did one bad thing and feels guilt or remorse out of proportion to the crime. Would a suicide bomber escape hell? Will a good person who died guilty go to hell? Where does come into it? Look, it's a suicide bomber. If they forgave themselves and realize that's a stupid thing to do, what do they do that for? If they really could forgive themselves, then they would actually not need to go to hell. But those sorts of people were probably in such a bad mind state And yeah, you would still, your stream of consciousness would be there afterward, and you saw the amount of pain and destruction. You come to your senses, my God, what have I done? And then you send yourself to hell because those sorts of people believe in that. They don't believe in forgiveness. If they did believe in forgiveness and live and let live, they wouldn't do that thing in the first place. So because people who actually blow other people up or kill other people, they believe in vengeance. Therefore they get vengeance. I was saying to someone today, it's one of the sayings I remember from my education in Christianity, judge not lest ye be judged. Which means if you judge other people, it's not that some God will judge you. If you judge others, you will be judged by you. By yourself. If you get angry at others, you get angry at yourself. If you sort of feel that other people need punishment, then you punish yourself. And that's the problem. So those suicide bombers, or the people who did the suicide bombing, because they believed that some punishment was necessary for these unbelievers, infidels, because they believed in punishment, they will punish themselves, for sure. But some of the good persons done one bad thing, as long as they've come to listen to monks like me, they think, I don't need to go to hell. So they won't. So you'll be free. You've got to come to monks like me a lot before you get brainwashed, because the other thing is brainwashed so much into you. I've done bad, I need to be punished. Punish me. If you are, I won't punish you, punish yourself. You know, okay, I have to have, you know, no sugar in my tea today, because I didn't get up early enough. You know, I can't give myself sort of an extra piece of toast, because, you know, I fell asleep during meditation. How many people punish themselves like that? Don't do that, that's stupid. And be happy, be free, let things go. You can do that, do it. It's much happier for you and other people. Wasn't the Buddha compassionate? Wasn't he kind? What is a compassionate and kind person? I said, never mind, I forgive you. At the end of a retreat, people often ask for forgiveness. Many of you have been to many retreats. You don't have to ask forgiveness, because the last time you came on a retreat, I gave you forgiveness for anything you do in the past, present and future. So you're already pre-forgiven. You know, and till eternity, till you get enlightened. So I've already forgiven you, whatever you do, forever. That's compassion. And it also makes my life easier. I don't have to keep forgiving you all the time. Do it once and get it over with. Okay, here we go. You stated that the Abhidharma came long after the Buddha. However, the Abhidharma, along with the Vinaya Sutta, was recited and purified Venerable Pali at the First Great Council, held within 3 months of the Buddha's Parinibbana. In other words, it must have been from the Buddha. Have a look at the text. It's in the Vinaya Pitaka. And in the Vinaya Pitaka, in the Chulawaga, where they have the account of the First Council, it said that they started with Ananda. It was Upali recited the Vinaya, and Ananda recited the Pancha Nikaya, the five Nikayas. And we all know who knows what those five Nikayas are. What's the first one? Digha Nikaya, very good. The second one? The Majjhima Nikaya, the middle length sayings. The third one? Sanyutta Nikaya, 3 out of 5, you're going well. And the fourth one? Kudaka Nikaya. That's got such things as the Sutta Nipata, the Jatakas. So we missed one, didn't we? It wasn't the fourth one. Anguttara is the fourth one. And the Kudaka is the fifth Nikaya. No mention at all of Abhidhamma. It's not there in that account of the fifth council, the first council. And that account of the first council is in the Agamas, the Chinese version, exactly the same, Pancha Nikaya, no Abhidhamma. And one of the other, so it's not actually in there. In the Vinaya Pitaka, where we have the account of the first council, no recension says the Buddha chanted, or anyone chanted, the Abhidhamma. Just the five Nikayas, which are the suttas, and the Vinaya, that's it. So actually, if you look at the evidence there, it wasn't chanted at the first council. Dear Ajahn, say that knowledge is coming through. the ears. Therefore, born deaf people are dumb. Other deaf people are disadvantaged of understanding, dumber, and let go. Please give your this to get better understanding with metta. Yeah, I mean, you know, sometimes I think, wouldn't it be wonderful to be deaf? Because, you know, sometimes all these things I have to listen to, you can actually meditate and you wouldn't hear anybody banging or coughing. You know, sure, you have a great advantage. You get into jhana very easily because no noise to disturb you. Brilliant. But you all know that sort of when one sense is disadvantaged, the other senses take up the slack and take up that position in the brain. So the other senses are harder to let go of. So basically it's exactly the same. And you don't need to have ears to know the Dhamma. You know, you can see it on the screen, you can read it. So, you know, it's fine that you don't need to sort of... people who are profoundly deaf can actually still very much get enlightened. No problem at all. So no difference there. Many years ago, during a meditation at Dhammaloka, my friend and I both had a similar experience. We both smelt a very sweet fragrance. It was brief but lovely. Could it have been a deva? Would you please say a little more about that, Ajahn? No, it's probably somebody passing wind. That's usually the only time the smell just comes and it just, you know, very, just a short, you know, must be some nice food or something, I don't know. Now, sometimes you can get deva smells, but very unlikely. It's usually sort of, you know, just natural smells, which, because we're very, very sensitive to smells. So, just a smell wafting around, something rather than incense or perfume or something else. So, it's not really a big thing. If you really see a deva, you know, real, not just smell one or just hear one, just see one, it's much more fun. Please describe some of the technical physical aspects of bowing. Okay, you go down and then you go up. And then you go down and you go up and then you go down and go up. That's how you bow. But, the reason why... So just follow what other people do, that's good enough. But when I bow, don't bow to a metal statue. I bow to what it represents. So the first time I bow to virtue. Because I worship virtue. And what I mean by worshipping? We hold it above us. That's what I mean by worshipping. That's the reason why sort of in Western culture, we know we bow a curtsy. We lower ourselves because we take that other thing to be higher and more important than us. So bowing is recognizing the value in what you bow to. So I bow to virtue because I value virtue. Then the second bow, I bow to peace, to stillness, you know, to samadhi. And the third one, I bow to compassion and wisdom. Those are the three things which I worship. And every time I bow to that, when I worship those things, it means I keep remembering that these are really important for me. So every time I bow, I'm reinforcing in my mindfulness the importance of virtue, no precepts of being good, of being still and being kind. So that's why I bow. That's what we do it for. Please also explain the posture used while doing morning evening chanting. I've noticed that monks and nuns, unlike most people, rest their bottoms on the back of their heels with a ball on the foot planted on the ground. This results in the feet folding half of the toes. I've tried this and it hurts a lot. I just get used to it. Keeps you awake. Now, it's just a tradition. You can do it any way you like. You know, if you can stand on one leg if you like, do the chanting. I won't say anything. So it's just the way we do it. So you can sit in the chair. So if you are sitting on the chair, don't sort of squat on the chair with, you know, your bottom on the balls of your feet like we're doing here. Otherwise you fall off. So it doesn't really matter. About the gunpowder and the match, what part of the teaching of the Buddha exactly one must hear? So the most important teaching, things like Four Noble Truths, things like non-self especially, there's no soul in here. You know, which is, Buddhism is the only religion which teaches that. There's nothing in here, emptiness. You know, the impermanence, not in the sense of things come and go, but things actually come and they go forever. And this idea of like the body and the mind being suffering. So why do you want to hold on to anything which is painful suffering? So those are the sorts of teachings. Because once the Buddha said that the reason why we're not enlightened is because we don't understand fully the Four Noble Truths. And that's such a powerful statement. Do you know the Four Noble Truths? What are the Four Noble Truths? The first truth? Suffering, yeah. The second truth? Cause of suffering. The third truth? And suffering, the fourth truth? Your path, yeah. So you know it, so you are enlightened. So what part of it don't you know? One of the things is, there's always some part of the world we think is not suffering. And that's where we want to live. A heaven, an original mind, some little corner of existence which we think is not going to be suffering. And that's where I'm going to go. And that's where I want us to become enlightened. When one applies dukkha to everything, everywhere, the whole lot, then one can let go. If you have an apple which is rotten, but there's a part of it which you think is okay, you won't need to throw away the apple. But if you know that apple is totally rotten, through and through, not one part which isn't sort of infected by this rotten thing, then you can throw it away. If you think that being, there's one little part somewhere which is worth saving, then you won't throw being away. But if you realize it's all dukkha through and through, then you'll throw it away. That's why people say, oh no, it's not suffering. It's only if you get attached it's suffering. So if you let it go, you can have fun. So you can have sex. It's not suffering. It's just if you get attached it's suffering. So just have sex being mindful and it's okay. Gee, just how much people just wiggle and squirm just to not to give up things. But the Buddha said it is suffering through and through. So if you really accepted that, you'd be enlightened, because people say, these monks, they're just weird. You know, they haven't had fun. You should get a life, monks. Get a relationship. You must be scared of women. That's why you become monks. So they have all these ideas, you know, why you become monks. So, that's the first thing. You think that anatta, anicca, you think, well, yeah, most things are impermanent, but there must be some little thing somewhere which is stable, like some God or like cosmic consciousness. So in the end, when we all get enlightened, we merge in cosmic consciousness. And that's the real thing which is eternal. Everything else comes and goes, just like waves on the lake, but the lake itself is permanent. And we always actually, it's amazing just how many of you believe that something somewhere is stable and permanent. The thing which listens to me right now, you think that's permanent. It's always there, it's always the same. You wake up in the morning, it's there. You go to bed at night, before you go to bed, it's there again. And you take that to be permanent. That's the thing which you recognize as yourself. That's why you're not enlightened. You look at that deeply and it's not permanent. It comes and goes, and in dharmas it disappears big time. And the last thing you think, what do you mean this non-self business? Yeah, we know the body's not a self. You know, we know we're going to die and get reborn. Yeah, we admit that. May our intelligence, we know our intelligence goes. We're going to all end up with Alzheimer's disease probably, so we forget everything. But at least some of you will. Be careful. Oh, you know, we think, well, you know, maybe I will. Don't really understand that, because that's a bit scary. You know, surely Ajahn Brahm is wrong on that one. So, you know, maybe my will is myself. But you have to let go of that, and your consciousness and knower. We always take something, somewhere, to be a self. That's why we don't get enlightened. So those are the big teachings which hit you. And I'm always really, really interested and surprised. Why is it that even monks, they wiggle and squirm to try and find some place where they can exist. Some original mind, cosmic consciousness, something where they could say, well, yeah, everything else is impermanent, but this thing isn't. This is the real thing. And why they think there's some place where they can, you know, some type of heaven where you can be happy ever after. Because, you know, it's, think about it, you've worked so hard and you've finally got enlightenment and you can't be there to enjoy it anymore. That sucks. But that's actually the way it is. So that's why people don't get enlightened. So those are the teachings you hear, and you don't believe them. You can't accept them. You can't accept them. If you're honest, you can't accept them, but they're there. They stay with you. And then when you get into things like jhanas, you see, my God, that's true. And this is the time when you get the experience. to realize that things which you cannot imagine to be true actually are true. And that's the end of you. If one gets jhana and hears these teachings, would it inevitably go bang, or can the gunpowder match meat but not go bang? If so, why not? It's because sometimes the match is too wet. In other words, you get a jar, it's not strong enough. Or the gunpowder is not enough, so it goes fizz. And it's not enough to destroy the defilements. But I like the idea of bang, because that's sometimes what happens. You get the incredible insights and it spins you out. And you go around, walking around the meditation retreat center, gee, what's happened? And you're a totally different person. You're spinning out and just see things in a totally different way. And that's actually the explosion that's gone off. But then you've got to wait for the dust to settle. And maybe it's after a few days, maybe weeks, maybe months and years, then you find out what's remaining. Because sometimes people have those experiences. They have big bangs, and they think they're enlightened. And they are like they're enlightened for a few days. And then they start getting angry or start getting desire up. And they realize, yeah, it was a bang, but not strong enough. So they have to have it again. To destroy the defilements. Noble silence, no exception to couples, please. Uh-oh. Couples, have you been scallywagging around? Hanky-panky in the cottages. Now you try and be... It's important, especially, if you're going to speak to each other, especially in your rooms, be quiet, because other people are meditating, they're all trying to rest. And for you think it's quiet. But, it actually does disturb other people. So at least in your cottage, that's the no speaking zone. So you're looking after other people. So if you want to talk, go outside. And if you want to need to talk. But if you have something to say, do the three checks first of all. Before you open your mouth, you've got to think, is this really important? Do I really need to say this? And if you contemplate, then, yeah, it is important. And the second check, is this really, really important? And if you think, yeah, it really, really is important, that's the second check. And the third check, is this really, really, really important? And if it is really, really, really important, then you can speak. But usually by that time they've gone away. So you could be quiet. Because a lot of times what you say is not important at all, so shut up. And if someone speaks to you, don't speak back. You put your finger in your mouth. That's what you need to do. Give them the one finger sign, but this way. And if they're persistent speaking, please come and see me, and I will give them the masking tape. We can put it around their mouth. We'll leave it in the hole for a straw so they can drink and they can suck up their dinner or their lunch. And so they'll have to mask it. No, that's sometimes. So please try and keep quiet. Especially at this time, because people are getting into it now, two or three days. Dear Venerable Ajahn, I plan to look for another apartment upon my return from the retreat. We've got a lot of apartments here. Just come and ordain. Should I stop moving on and accept it? Please advise, I'm confused. On November, I just moved to this new place. On that day, the owner started to build the upper level. The noise of digging, banging and shouting from workers in Asian countries 7 days a week will last at least 3 months. It is very difficult to meditate. Is it good or bad, or just suppress it and learn to live with it? Please give advice. Thank you. It's, if you are in such a situation, it's really very noisy, then it's actually bad for their health because you can't sleep. And in Asia, they don't have unions, so they work at all hours, Saturdays and Sundays. Sometimes they start really early, they finish pretty late. It'd be great if they had unions. I was thinking of getting a union for monks one day, so I can actually have a nice, easy time and increase my pay, which is pretty low at the moment, but actually I'm happy. So, another apartment on return from this retreat, just whatever you want to do. But if you're in a very noisy place, probably the best thing to do is to rent an apartment for 3 months or something, so you can, if you can afford it, so the apartment, you don't have all that noise, and wait until they finish building the second story. And next time you buy an apartment or rent an apartment, have a look at the plans first of all. Have an idea what they're going to do next in that apartment. I don't know what they're doing on the top story. There might be a karaoke bar, in which case you're in big trouble. So, whatever they're doing, next time when you get an apartment, be more careful to make sure that you understand what plans are going to happen next. And if it's only 3 months, and if that was me, and I've had the funds, I'd just rent another apartment. Or even better, come on retreat for 3 months here. You can stay here for another 3 months, and when you get home, the work is finished, and it's nice and peaceful and calm. So that's what I would do. Because, you know, noise, yeah, you can let go of it a little bit, but when it gets too much, especially banging all day, that will just really not give you any sleep and just cause a lot of physical ill health. Dear Ajahn, have you ever thought about holding a 16-day meditation retreat? I reckon it's a brilliant idea. Some people are having a 16-day meditation retreat. They're having a 22-day meditation retreat, because they did the first retreat with the Singaporeans and they've continued on, and they're doing another 9-day retreat now. Very clever people. So, have I ever thought about it? No, because I don't think. Just you can think about it and tell me about it afterwards. I get really sort of tired and squeezed, and you want me to do a 16-day meditation retreat, then you want me to come to London, then you want me to come to San Francisco, then you want me to sort of go and give more talks in Nolamara, and then, oh, I get so squeezed and I get abused. You know, my arm is very sore because it gets twisted and twisted and twisted every day. So, yeah, no, you think about these things, but anyway. Aha! You talked about euthanasia the other night. Aren't you cutting it a bit close to Varajika? Can't imagine you being a layperson. No, neither can I. Now, I know my rules. To be actually Varajika, this is actually for killing. You have to have the intention to destroy somebody's life. And you have to, you know, be the person who actually basically brings that about. So with the euthanasia debate, it's a very interesting one. But those of you who followed what I was saying, it was voluntary euthanasia which I was supporting, not euthanasia. Voluntary euthanasia is where the person who is about to die has full control. It's they make the decision, not the doctor, not me. Because I'm out of it, it's not my decision. I'm not coercing them. I'm not encouraging them. Therefore, basically, the rule for killing is not my responsibility. So with voluntary euthanasia, you're giving that responsibility to the individual. Basically, it's their choice over their body, what they wish to do. So you're taking the legal thing away from that. And the law of karma is that each one of us is responsible for our karma. It's up to us. And voluntary euthanasia is just another form of suicide. It's called assisted suicide. Is suicide wrong? Did the Buddha commit suicide? What is suicide anyway? You deliberately end your own life. 3 months before the Parinibbana, at the chapel or shrine, the Buddha abandoned his will to live, one of the four nutriments to keep this body going. There's a strong argument to say he committed suicide. He deliberately, intentionally would end his life. When he ate that pork, his last meal, he knew what he was doing. He knew that was killing. He deliberately took it. Isn't that intentionally ending his life? Didn't the Buddha commit suicide? That's suicide by most definitions. But it's another holy cow, isn't it? A Buddha can't commit suicide. That is wrong. But it's a lot of time comes from the Christian idea. The Christian Judaic idea of this is your only life. So the most important thing is to keep yourself alive at all costs. And killing yourself is one of the most evil things to do in Christianity, in Judaism, in Islam. Because it's not this life was given to you by God, and you're sort of denying God. And that's why it's called evil. And we've actually accepted that, you know, into sort of our cultures. And we don't really think about it. We just assume suicide is bad. But, you know, you ask, is it? In some situations, intentionally sacrifice your life for a good cause. A person who gives up their life, say, in a conflict, they know it's going to kill them, but they do it to save others. That's called noble. There was the case, I think, in the Second World War, when there was, I think, a priest, I think in Belsen, and somebody else was chosen to go into the gas chamber. He said, no, you stay, I'll go in your place. That's deliberately ending his own life. It's suicide, by every definition, but for a wonderful, good cause. So it's considered to be a hero. You have Jan Palach in Czechoslovakia, who committed suicide by burning himself as a protest against the Soviet occupation of Prague. He is a national hero. There is a square named after him in the center of Prague, Jan Palach Square. There are cases like that where people, many people, maybe not you, say that suicide was a noble thing. So I'm asking you to rethink. Always question and don't have too many assumptions. And then maybe you'll understand why voluntary euthanasia. The only reason I think we haven't got it yet is because people are afraid of death in our societies. So afraid that it's a red line we're just not ready to cross yet, even though it's going to help ease so much suffering with voluntary euthanasia. Anyway, interesting to get you to question. And again, there's very good evidence the Buddha committed suicide. When the minds of listeners were open and malleable, he would teach them the Four Noble Truths of suffering. Why did he choose to frame the central teaching of suffering rather than anatta or anicca? However, when someone became a stream winner, they framed the understanding in terms of anicca. All that is subject to arising, all that is subject to cessation. Because it's dukkha, anicca, anatta, it's all the same, all three aspects of the same teaching. Because it's only, you know, when you see suffering, you can actually let go of things. But even if you see suffering, because it's mine, you know, even though it's suffering, at least I exist. Which is why I've seen many people, when they are on their deathbed, they won't let go and die. They'd rather suffer and be than have no suffering and not exist. So actually the craving to be is actually stronger than the aversion to suffering. So you can see suffering, but it's much deeper than that. And the craving to be, to exist, is the paramount one. And when it's anicca, it's not just rise and fall, it's actually things are subject to cessation. Your body, your mind, your will is subject to stopping. It can end. Whoopee. The Ajahn, today I went to sit for meditation. I could see many trees when I closed my eyes. It felt like I was still trying to escape to somewhere and that I was trying to meditate to a formula. So I let my eyes be open and tried to feel that all the love and peace and freedom I could ever wish for in the present. Could you please comment on this approach? If it works, wonderful. So if you sit down and you close your eyes, you think of escaping to somewhere because you're visualizing trees and visualizing coffee shops and visualizing restaurants, you know, at 5 o'clock in the afternoon, then maybe you are trying to escape from something. But if you visualize like beautiful mountains and caves and peace and bliss, then fine. So it's okay to escape. To escape from suffering. That's what this is all about. Sometimes, many years ago, someone said, I figured out you monks are just trying to escape from life. I said, yes, you understand. Come and escape with me. When you realize you're in prison, that's the only thing you really want to do, to escape. When you think your prison is a beautiful place, then you never want to escape. So yeah, we are all escapologists as monks. So, but you let your eyes be open and try and feel all love and peace and freedom. It's great, you get somewhere, but you know, seeing things is always very distracting. You might get some love and peace and a big crow comes and sits in front of you. And just ugly thing and just disturbs you. So if you close your eyes, you've got less things to agitate the brain. That's why we like to close our eyes. I can't see any of you. You're all gone. Bye-bye. Now I can be at peace. So we close our eyes, we close our senses for the sake of peace. So that's the best, to close everything. Please, how to practice non-self? Must it necessary to contemplate on a skeleton? Sadhu. No, you don't have to contemplate on a skeleton. The only reason why you contemplate on skeletons is to realize that, look, if you have lust to anybody in this place, what are you having lust towards? You know, just think of their skeleton. But as a skeleton, I know that some people actually, when they fall in love, they say, you're so beautiful. You know, your beauty is everywhere. I mean, you've got a beautiful skeleton. Look at your bones. They're wonderful bones. But no, even better than that, go deeper inside the bones, into their intestines. So can you love everything about them? So don't squeeze them too hard, because people like toothpaste tubes. If you squeeze too hard, something comes out of the end. Come on, be gross. So that's how you practice non-self. Just, you know, what is it anyway? And all that food you eat, you know, really strange. All your food you eat is all of a different colour when it goes in, but it all comes out the same colour. Where does all that colour go? I never figured that one out. Anyway, practice non-self. How you practice non-self, it's none of my business. Not me, not mine, not a self. And the best one is not mine. So if there's not a self in there, who's the owner of anything? You don't own your meditation. So all your idea of achieving something, who's achieving anything anyway? Who's failing? There's no one in there. So you can't fail on this retreat. There's no one to fail. You can't sort of be successful, because there's no one to be successful. There's no one there. It reminds me of that joke I told. Actually, I hadn't told Bhamani before. I told this at Bhamalaka a few days ago. I think I told it on the previous retreat about the three monks, the priest, the rabbi, and the monk. That was a previous retreat, wasn't it? Haven't told it on this one yet. There was a priest, a rabbi, and a monk. And they were doing this interfaith meetings. You know that we all have to do interfaith meetings these days. It's just par for the course. It's de rigueur. So, you know, they're meeting together and discussing different things to get a bit more harmony in our world. And, you know, meeting so often on these interfaith gatherings, they actually became quite friends and said, look, if we really want to take this to the next level, you know, we should come to each other's houses, maybe have lunch or tea or something. So they started having lunch with each other, you know, every sort of once a week or something. They said, well, look, you know, we need to sort of have some activity actually to bring us even closer together. So they decided just to, you know, play cards together. It's so easy to do. One thing led to another, and just not cards, we're actually gambling, having a great time. But, you know, that's actually illegal. So, you know, they got busted. The police found them, and so they got arrested. They had to go to court. And there they were in court, the three of them, the Christian priest, the rabbi and the Buddhist monk. And the judge got the priest up first of all and said, you've been accused of gambling. You're a religious leader. You're supposed to be honest and be an example to the community. So I'm just going to not mess around. I'm just going to ask you directly, were you gambling? And the priest quickly looked up to the heavens and under his breath he muttered, forgive me, Lord. No, he lied. And so the next one in the dock was the rabbi. He said, you two are a religious leader, somebody who's an example to others. You teach other people to be honest, so now I'm going to ask you, were you gambling? And the rabbi put his hands behind his back and crossed his fingers. No, he said. And so the last one was a Buddhist monk. And the judge says, you know, you too keep these precepts. And the Buddha once said to his son, Ananda, that anybody who lies, who tells the truth, they're empty of the religious life. So you hold that honesty very, very dearly. So I'm going to ask you too, monk, where are you gambling? And the monk said, with whom? So when there's no one in here, with whom? There's no me in here. So you've got nothing to worry about. You're totally free. That's how I practice non-self. No one in here. Great. So you can, don't blame me. I don't exist. Does delusion only exist in the space between object and consciousness? Is it like a way of viewing? Delusion, yeah, it's just our way of viewing. It's part of our view, the way that we actually perceive things through delusion. So when I'm deluded, sort of, you know, what I really like, and that's really delicious, why isn't it that everybody else doesn't appreciate fish and chips? I mean, it's obvious. It's the most delicious food in the whole world. Now, why do you have this other food? Now, why do you like rice and curry? Why do you not like spaghetti? You must be dumb. Why do you like what I like? It's the best. That's called delusion. Or, you know, when you hate somebody. Now, Adolf Hitler. He's a bad fellow. No, he wasn't. Was he? No, he was a vegetarian. He was. And he loved his mother. And so, was he a bad guy? Or was he just a guy who did bad things? He wasn't an evil man. He was a person who did some bad things. So delusion is, they're totally bad. They're a murderer. You're a liar. You're a thief. That's delusion. Which means we can justify ourselves getting angry at somebody. That's delusion. And delusion, you look at yourself. This is me. So, I am a good meditator. I'm a good teacher. I'm a terrible person. I'm hopeless. I sleep too much. I eat too much. I'm fat. You know, I realized the other day, I'm not fat. I'm actually anorexic. Because I read, and no, look, it's true, because I read in this journal, the definition of anorexia, you look in a mirror and you think you're fat. So I thought, that's me. See, that's delusion. Okay, this is a good question. Can't take too much bliss and get excited. Solution. Experience. With experience, you find you can take more bliss. So you just, you know, you sort of build up your sort of ability. What is it? Resistance. Yeah, resistance to bliss or whatever it is. Tolerance, that's the word. You build up your resistance, your tolerance to extreme bliss. So after a while hanging out here, you can really take more than most other people ever believed was possible. It's true because, look, that was a personal experience that sometimes when you were meditating, you think no person can actually have so much bliss without exploding. It's just too much to exist. But then you get more bliss and you find you're still there. So in other words, you can take extreme bliss and survive. Isn't that wonderful? What a great insight. There's no limit to the amount of bliss you can have. So go for it. And you deserve it. How do you explain karma to someone who is unsure about it? Please explain. You say it's your karma to be unsure about it. But if you do lots of donations and feed monks, help out washing the dishes and clean up the Buddhist society in Dhammaloka, then by making such good karma, you'll understand how important karma is. But just actually look at life and law of karma, it's just so obvious. Whenever you've done a kind, good thing, how do you feel? Just see karma at work in your life. So, you know, whenever I've done a kind, good thing, you know, and just helped and served, and, you know, we're just talking about one of the other monks. We're trying to get him to teach the retreat in June. He's got to teach a retreat afterwards. And he said, I can't do two retreats in a row. I'm not like Ajahn Brahm. That's what his result is. He said, well, of course you can. And if you do more good karma, you actually get more energy, more happiness. So, you know, the more I do, the more energy I get. So that's actually how it works. So, you know, you just keep on being kind. The more you wash the dishes, the more you sweep the paths, the more you wash out your toilet bowl to keep it nice and clean, the more bliss you get and energy you get. So if your meditation is not going very well, then clean out your toilet bowl. And you know, see if you can clean out somebody else's toilet bowl in the cottage. Clean them all out. And then, you know, when they're really nice and bright and everything is very nice, then you've got so much merit you can get deep meditation. Do you believe me? It's actually, it's true. Because when I became, when I was a young monk, I didn't understand this karma business and making merit. Didn't seem to be like just a way that the abbot, the teachers there, could get you to work hard. You know, just a way of exploiting you. You know, you work hard, you get lots of merit. Okay, Ajahn Brahm, so you work from that. And all those abbots, they were just sitting in their hut, enjoying themselves, drinking cups of tea. I thought this was exploitation and abuse. Until you actually started doing it yourself and realised it works. I already mentioned just about, I think yesterday, about how the monks would make their robes. And when they were making their robes, they would stay up many nights in a row. And that time when I knew there was a tea there and I went to get my cup of tea before three, but they were actually bringing it to me so I missed it. So it was a simile, if you go looking for something, you always miss it. If you sit there, it always comes to you. But on this one occasion, some other monks, actually, I don't know if any of you know Ajahn Kwesakow, he was one of those monks. He's like a famous abbot in where is he now, in Kanchanaburi, Mitsui Shibahashi, Kwesakow, Ajahn Kwesakow, the Japanese monk. Actually, because his name was Shibahashi, and that was just too difficult for a Thai to say, so Ajahn Chah nicknamed him Seabart Harsip, which means, you know, 4 baht 50, like $4.50. And that was his name. He's a famous monk now. He started off as, you know, $4.50. Seabart Harsip. And that was Ajahn Kwesakow in Kanchanaburi. So anyway, he was one of these monks. He was making his robes. And staying up all night for that 3 or 4 days, two or 3 days. And they'd always been up for too long. And just, if you'd gone without sleep, you know, it's just really tough. And so after the evening meeting, I went to the dying shed and said, look, you guys, you just go and have a rest. I'll look after the dying pot all night for you. I'm not going to have a rest. But I'd rested the night before. You can have a rest. I'm a kind monk. And of course, they were just so grateful that they could just lay down and rest. They were just so tired. So I looked after the dying pot all night until 3 o'clock. And then 3 o'clock the bell went and they came, you know, they had a 4 or 5 hours sleep. And then they came to look after the dying pot. And I went to the morning chanting. I had all this energy. You're meditating, you know, sloth and torpor, perfectly straight, very clear. I never had so much energy, you know, for the morning meditation, the morning session. And then when you're going on arms round, I remember talking to Ajahn Sumedho on the way back. This is really weird. I haven't slept all night. And I feel so bright and alert. He said, what have you done? I said, I will help these monks all night. He said, that's why. Good karma. And that was one of the first times I realized that's actually true. If you make some really good karma and help somebody out, you don't get tired, you get blissed. So that's why I don't think, oh, I'm tired, I need to go to sleep. If you go and help somebody out, you get this huge boost of energy, and it's really nice energy. It's beautiful energy, which means you get happiness, it's easy to meditate. That's one of the reasons I serve so much. Because I enjoy it, get blissed out on this, it's part of my meditation practice. So don't think, oh, Bianca's got me doing all these duties. I never came here to do duties, and I came here to meditate. And look, my meditation is just going well. I have to go and do the kitchen duties. This is really unfair. Can't I actually give an extra maybe $20 to get out of doing duties? Now, those duties are actually part of the retreat, and actually if you put sort of effort into them, you do the very best, and maybe you help somebody else do their duties for them. Then you really get some nice meditation. So this is actually why we understand the law of karma. And it's a beautiful law because it works. You can test it out in your life. You go and help someone do some good acts of karma. That, look, all my generosity which I did. That every time I remember some of the generous things which I did. What was one of those times that I was a member of the Buddhist Society in Cambridge and actually got some really boring talks. I used to go to sleep when these old professors and monks, like Dr. Sadatis, he was really boring. But, you know, as a Buddhist, I thought I had to go. But, you know, one of the nicest talks I remember, this was this Tibetan Buddhist nun, a Westerner. And she wasn't a meditator, but she was just running an orphanage in Sikkim. And when she was telling me what she was doing, I thought, wow, what a wonderful thing it's doing. It's like compassion. I got inspired. And so I went to the bank next day and drew £10 out of my account to send as a donation. And that was 2 weeks' food money for me. And I was a poor student. That meant I actually went hungry. I never starved. It was not bad for my health. But, you know, I really sort of felt that in my tummy. So it was actually quite a sacrifice. It wasn't sort of something you could just give away and you wouldn't notice it. You know, physically that actually hurt me. £10 for a poor student in 1969 or 70. But I'd never regret that. I just get so much happiness out of that. Even today, 50, 45 years, well, it's about 40 years since. Because it hurt. That's why I get so much joy out of it. So I understand the law of karma. It's great. So that's why you just give as much as you can. That's why, last story, it was in Singapore. I was visiting one of the temples there. And the first time I was visiting, I was walking around there and the monk was showing me around. And then, just before we're leaving, he said, oh, why don't you sign a visitor's book? So I picked up the visitor's book and wrote my name, Ajahn Brahm, and the address, you know, Bodhinyana Monastery in Serpentine. And the next line was how much I was donating. I picked up the donation book instead of the visitor's book. And there you'd already written your name and the monastery, so I thought, you can't leave that blank. So I was put in a very difficult position. You know, I put my name, the address, and then how much you're going to donate. And the insight came into my mind. And I wrote down MYLIFE, my life. And that's in the donation book there sometimes in this temple. What is it called? I forget what the temple's called. Anyway, Sri Lankan temple. So that's my donation for you. I donate my life. Yeah, are you going to donate yours? Ah, come on. At least anyway, donate 5 minutes and meditate a bit more. Because that's the last question. Or you can donate your body to sleep. I hereby donate my body to my pillow. My bed. Have a nice night's sleep. So that's all the questions for tonight. So thank you for the people who asked the questions. I hope the answers were up to the standard of the questions. If they weren't, don't worry, because it wasn't me. I take no responsibility at all, because there's nobody in here. So isn't that wonderful? You can go to bed thinking, well, did I do a good job? Did I do a bad job? I didn't do any job. So totally free. So have you had a good day or a bad day? Good, bad, who knows? Very good. So see what happens. Have a good night. See you tomorrow, maybe.